information. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part one of today's program, we're going to be talking about a group that has done great work for four decades here in southeastern Wisconsin, the Kenosha Women's Network. And they are celebrating their 40th anniversary in a real big way with a gala that is coming up on September 17th. With us in the studios of WGTD this morning, again for part one of today's program, is Roseanne Shales, who is president of the Kenosha Women's Network, and Guida Brown, who is vice president. And it sounds like over the course of the last few years, both Roseanne and Guida have been very, very active in this organization and have been working tirelessly to keep their good work going. So we have both of them with us today to talk about the organization itself, their good work, and about this celebratory gala that is coming up on September 17th. Roseanne Shales, Guida Brown, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg.
Thank you.
Good that you can be here. Really appreciate it. Roseanne, I was talking with you right before we went on the air a little bit about the earliest days of the Kenosha Women's Network, and I don't know if your involvement dates all the way back to then, but you obviously have some good awareness of why this group was created. Tell us a little bit about the earliest days of the Kenosha Women's Network.
Yes, just to be fair, Guida and I came in a little bit later in the organization, but the organization was started in 1980, actually as an offshoot of the National Organization for Women now, and a year later became its own group. So a bunch of people looking to support women basically started a daytime lunch so that people could gather and work together about things that were happening in their days. That was the time when women were just getting jobs in management, moving up in positions that they hadn't been in before. And it was actually a place where they could go and talk about their issues and figure out how to work together to build their careers and continue growing with other women. In 1981, they decided to become a nonprofit organization. And we have continued that till this day.
So that's really the anniversary that's being celebrated in a sense.
Yeah. Yes, yes. We were going to do this last year and COVID shut us down for the actual date anniversary, but we had another one just right ahead.
Absolutely. This is also something to celebrate. You were telling me, again, when we were chatting, about one of the very first grants that was given out by the Kenosha Women's Network. It's a really heartwarming story and kind of speaks to what this group has been all about, and maybe particularly in the early days, what many of the grants were given for. Would you mind sharing that story with our listeners?
Sure. As we got beyond just connecting women together and supporting women, in 2003, I believe, we had Bev Jamboy, who was a member then, was working with the Foster Parent Association, and there was a couple that was trying to bring home five brothers from Texas to adopt them. the biggest thing that they needed was a bigger washer and dryer. So one of our members, when Bev brought this up, we talked about it, and we had money in our coffers. It was not assigned to anything. And so we decided to make our first grant, and we spent the $3,500 to get them that washer and dryer to help that family.
Wow. Love that. So what drew you to want to become part of the Kenosha Women's Network when you started becoming involved? Anything in particular?
Well, I've always been pro-woman, and I'm always looking to meet more interesting and powerful women in the community and beyond, because they're so much fun to talk to and learn from, and they become mentors, right? And I was young at the time. I was early 30s. And I joined the Kenosha Women's Network just to learn and grow and support the community. I had owned a business in Illinois at the time. And so I was kind of coming back home at that time. I had just sold the business, so I needed to get local.
Hmm. Make some connections and
yes.
so on.
Yes.
Very good. Guida Brown, tell us about what drew you to want to become part of the Kenosha Women's Network. When did that happen and why?
Oh, gosh. I wish I remembered my days better. I know why. It was when I was working at Women and Children's Horizons. And I know people who know me well don't believe this, but I am pathologically shy. And my issue... Roseanne's laughing. Entree into the Kenosha Women's Network was because of being an executive director in a nonprofit. You need to make those connections. I think that nonprofit work is some of the hardest that we have to do because we don't get to just be the CEO. We don't only know about our organization. We have to know about all the organizations. And so being in the network was the way to learn about other people and what other businesses were doing. But getting into leadership in the Kenosha Women's Network just helped me to not be pathologically shy. I could go to meetings. I always say, if you met me at a party where I only knew the host, you'd find me by the food table. Yeah, I would just be praying somebody would talk to me, and I would be hiding in a corner shoving food in my face. And so the Kenosha Women's Network gave me an opportunity when I'm in charge of something. I look like I'm not shy. And so I just really got in both feet and started with the newsletter and ended up as president for a while and just made a lot of connections. So then when I went into a place, I always knew somebody. That was sort of the entree and just such a great benefit. Now it's so funny because I'm the one sending out the email saying, hey, I want to do this. Does anyone want to go with me? And we have a group going to see Black Violin, and we have a group going to see another concert. And it's just such a great community because of that.
Very good. And you're not quite as shy as you
used Well, to not there, yeah.
Very good. I noticed on your website that your membership actually draws from more than Kenosha and more than Kenosha County, actually, several different counties in southeast Wisconsin and even Lake County in Illinois. Has that always been the case?
I would say, well, we've never excluded anyone. Hmm. You know, lunch is open to everyone that wants to attend. Actually, we're not exclusive to just women either. We did have a male member once. It was Antaramian in his first term.
Ah, okay.
Don't remember. I think that was before my time. But you hear that story. The men are welcome if they want to. They're involved and interested in the things that we do. And we do draw. We have gone as far as South Milwaukee and into Lake County and all the way across Kenosha County into Walworth County. And it just depends on people live and work.
What would you say is maybe some of the most important ways in which the mission or the focus of the Kenosha Women's Network has changed over the course of this 40-year history? Because, you know, you describe a certain scenario in 1980 that is probably not quite the same sort of cultural, societal landscape in which we find ourselves now in 2021, which is not to say that there isn't all kinds of work yet to do, but it's kind of a different world 40 years later. So would you say there are ways in which the Kenosha Women's Network has changed in terms of mission or focus?
You know, I'm sure there are, but I think what has happened is actually a greater entrenchment in supporting nonprofits in our community. So now we do a mini grant process. And so while the process is different, that's really sort of one of the tenets, the philanthropy of the agency. We do fundraisers throughout the year. We have a big holiday lunch. The gala is a partial fundraiser, and the rationale behind that is that every year we do mini grants to the community. The nonprofits write for not huge amounts of money, around $2,000 is probably the max, and we give them out to about five or six organizations. So it's still, we're still there. We're still doing that. We're not giving, you know, money to individuals to buy washers and dryers, but we could be giving money to organizations to buy washers and dryers. And the focus is on serving women and children. We're a huge part of the Susan B. Anthony Awards dinner. We're one of the sponsors of that. So yeah, the mission over the years has changed. I like to say that we have three tenets. We have the networking, the lunches, the philanthropy, and then just the getting together and you know, being friends with people and being out in the community and having fun. So it's a great group if you want to start getting involved in the community or just, you know, maintain. I know Roseanne told the story about why it started. I believe that women work differently than men do. And so back in the day when all the men were going to the Rotary meetings and the Kiwanis meetings and they were counting that towards work, women weren't able to do that. That was lunch. And I think we still do that to some degree. We carve out like, oh, I went to lunch today. I can't count that on my timesheet. Whereas men are like, I spent 8 hours on the golf course working. And so that's Kenosha Women's Network was a monthly event because that was when women could carve out that time and still get to that lunch. And it remains a monthly event. So, again, just a great organization.
Well, and in addition, Guida, you know, we've added some things like movie night and book clubs and other ways for people to connect with us, get to know us. You don't have to be a member to come to lunch. We actually say you can come a couple of times before you decide, though many people do decide on the very first day or even join before they've attended. We just had a new group of three. We have a group membership where you can have up to three people from the same organization at a reduced rate so that we can they can circle people in based on the time and workload that people have.
Very good. You were mentioning, Roseanne, before we went on the air that COVID was kind of a sock to the jaw, and not, of course, just for the Kenosha Women's Network, but for all kinds of organizations which involve people gathering together. Can you talk about how you've tried to carry on? I mean, I know, among other things, COVID ended up, in a sense, canceling what would have been your gala last year. And I'm sure it's been a hindrance in a lot of other ways, too. How has your group attempted to carry on through this pandemic?
Sure. Well, to give you a slight example of financially how this affected us, a year ago, we donated $9,000 into the community through our mini grants. Last year, at the end of the mini grant, this spring, it was $5,000, $5,500 actually, because we just had not been able to do the fundraising that we used to do. And so the gala is going to help us recoup that, we hope, add a little bit, because our Christmas lunch is very stable. Even last year on our holiday luncheon, we did that at the Kenosha Country Club. We had 36 people attend, but we made just shy of $500 less than we did with 100 people the year before.
Wow.
So people really stepped up, sent extra money, made donations to help us so that we had some decent amount of money, that $5,500 that we were able to give away. And so this event will have a small silent auction, I believe a 50-50, and of course part of the ticket cost, roughly half, will go back to helping us get us back on track to the money, the grants that we'd like to be giving. Our goal is to get to 10,000 sometime very soon and be able to continue that.
Right. You know, I hadn't even thought about that. I was thinking of the impact in terms of it's maybe harder to gather for the regular events that you do with the networking and so on. I hadn't even stopped to think about the impact on fundraising, because in so many instances, those are events as well. And so many of those were impossible last year.
So we did do some things, and Guida helped organize this. We initially, when we reopened, because we did shut down for COVID, we were doing online Zoom meetings. I'm sure many people understand how unexciting Zoom meetings can be.
Awful. You try. I think that's the word. Awful.
Awful. Yes, I call it, we get the Zoom smile on and listen a lot, right? Yeah. And try to, you know, stay interested in an hour-long gathering of a bunch of people all doing the same thing.
Right.
So we went back in, I think it was around May. Was it May? I think we started having our meetings. We started with a group of 10 to 15. We worked with the organization, the Women's Club, which is where we meet. So they would allow us as low as 10 people because they wanted us to come back. Mm. You know, we support them as another charity as well, mm-hmm. because they're also a 501c3. So we started with, I think it was 13, and then we got to 15, and roughly now we're getting 20-ish. And in the past, we would have been at 30 to 40 for lunch every month. And now, of course, we've got a COVID effect coming back. So we hope to stay open and continue to be in a safe environment where people can gather and support each other.
Yeah, we're lucky in that the Women's Club has allowed us to use the larger room. So it really seats 200 and, you know, we've got 15 people. So we've got a lot of social distancing going on. People wore their masks. You know, everyone's really respectful of the expectations and the COVID precautions. And so that, it's more about just the comfort level of people gathering. And that has been a challenge. And like Roseanne said, is just now becoming another challenge. But we do the best we can. The other thing, she mentioned the movie nights. And so the movie theaters had given the opportunity to have private showings. And so we had a lot of private showings, just an opportunity to get people together. You rent out the whole movie theater and you can get 20 people in there. And again, with the social distancing and the masks. And it was just a lot of fun and a means to still socialize, even though you weren't really socializing. You know, right. You were sort of sitting and watching a movie by yourself.
Right. But I'm sure that felt good, though, at least to me.
You got out, yeah.
Yeah. Out of the house and within four different walls other than your own.
Yes.
For those of you just joining us, we are talking with Roseanne Shales and Guida Brown. They are president and vice president, respectively, of the Kenosha Women's Network, which has a 40th anniversary gala that is coming up. And we'll give you the details of that in just a moment. Roseanne, could you just briefly explain what a nonprofit has to do to apply for a mini grant from the Kenosha Women's Network? Is that an arduous gauntlet we're talking about?
No, it's really a one-page, three-question form that you fill out. Any nonprofit organization, 501c3, is welcome to request one when we get to mini grant time, which is roughly end of April, early May. We award the grants in July, so they're announced in June. So there's a window of roughly 45 days where you can apply, and you tell us what you're looking for, tell us what you need. We have a committee it's an ad hoc committee. I chair it with other board members and non-board members alike, and roughly six people, and we go through them and figure out what we can do. Someone may ask for $1,000, you might only give them $500, this particular year, the COVID year, we were able to give 5,500, as I said before. We'd like to get to 10,000, this year, and that will take us to about 100,000 donated since we started the program. And this is all Kenosha, women and children in Kenosha.
Fantastic. And Guida, I want you to say a word about the Susan B. Anthony Woman of Influence Awards that, as was said earlier, the Kenosha Women's Network has a real major hand in.
Yeah. So there are three sponsoring organizations, and Kenosha Women's Network is one of them. We require that they pay a pittance, $100, $150, just to be a sponsoring agency, and then they also donate a prize. I'm talking about them like I'm not them. I'm both. I'm. And then they donate a $300 raffle prize as well to be a sponsor, and we've done that since the very beginning. The Susan B. Anthony. early on, it was just one organization. And then we, you know, obviously more partners makes it a better event. And Susan B. is sort of the same. We do grants to the nonprofits. We award a woman of influence who has served Kenosha County, and then three other categories now that we added a few years ago. Same thing, though. I mean, last year, we actually did fairly well. We were able to do the grants, but we did a non-event because of COVID. And right. So this year, we're looking forward to March 4th, I believe is the Friday, March 4th. But yeah, same issues and, you know, same uphill battle we've been facing.
So. Right. Hopefully the clouds are parting here soon.
Hopefully. Yes. Hopefully.
Well, let's talk about this celebratory gala, your 40th anniversary gala that's coming up at the Women's Club on September 17th. So explain to our listeners what's going to be happening the night of September 17th.
Sure. Well, the night kicks off. We call this a gala, so feel free to dress up. If you're a suffragette, you could even dress like that if you wanted to, because that's what we're celebrating, right? The right to vote. At 5 o'clock, we start with a cash bar. It's basically beer and wine at the Women's Club. That is something that people can choose or not to choose to take part in. At 6 o'clock, and of course, mingle and talk and get to know everybody. At 6 o'clock, we'll serve dinner, and we have three dinner options. So we have a beef, a chicken, and a vegetarian. So we've tried to include everybody with dessert. And I have to tell you, Chef David at the Women's Club does fabulous desserts. And then at 7 o'clock, we have Leslie Goddard, an acclaimed historic reenactor. And she has a PhD in women's history and a master's in theater, so she's brilliant. I've seen her more than once. She has a huge repertoire of things to do. We selected Alice Paul because this meant to be, you know, for the 100th year of women getting the right to vote, and we wanted her to continue with that choice.
Right. So Alice Paul, one of the most important suffragists, especially towards the end of that long battle.
Yeah, and I promise you'll think that you're listening to Alice Paul in 1918. She's that good. She'll take you right back to those days. And it's a $40 ticket. Roughly half that's going to come back to supporting our grant fund.
Wow. That's really something. And so for $40, you're getting the dinner and the performance and just the time to get together, plus the funds get donated, much of them get donated back to the worthy causes that you support.
Yes.
Sounds like a winning proposition in every respect. Guida Brown, I suspect that you are also hoping, as kind of the years go, to continue to kind of expand the scope of the Kenosha Women's Network, and I suppose even hoping to also draw in more members.
Absolutely, yeah. We, you know, before COVID, we had great goals.
Well, now, we still do.
We do. We have great goals. We want to expand. We'd love to be back to our numbers of 100 members. It's been a little thin because of COVID, I would say. But
yeah, right.
You know, it really is a great organization. We really are sort of a mainstay in the community, and there aren't a lot of organizations that exist for 40 years supporting the community. And I think that's the big part of it. People should understand that we really are about the philanthropy, about giving back to the nonprofit world in Kenosha County, and that we are just a great networking opportunity. I still, you know, we're all struggling. I'm also a member of Tempo. Tempo is struggling. Just COVID struggle, not, you know, not financial whatever, but COVID struggle. And the Rotaries and the Kiwanis, you know, you hear about them merging. And, you know, so everyone, it's sort of a grab for time more than anything, I think it is. And the opportunity to get out. And then COVID just really changed the world. And life became so much easier to stay in our offices. Mm. And it's not as fun, but we're used to it now, I think. And so people are hesitant, maybe because of COVID, but also because of just the and I haven't had to leave my office for a year. Why would I want to leave my office and go right. someplace? And, you know, Kenosha is a pretty wide space. And so now I have to get all the way downtown for lunch. It's just easier not to go. So we really have to sort of a value added. Why would people want to come? And so one of our things at our lunches is that we always have a speaker and we do the networking and we it's just fun. And like I said, you can go in and meet people and feel like you have, I always say I feel like I have like 40 sisters, 40 friends that I can just engage to go anywhere I want. And I don't have that opportunity anywhere else. So I hope other people appreciate that and continue to support and be members and even grow the organization.
For more information about the Kenosha Women's Network, you can go to your website, which is laid out very, very nicely. And do you happen to remember, either of you remember the address for it?
Sure. KenoshaWomen'sNetwork.org. And then once you get there, look for the box that shows all the gala info. You just click on it. It takes you right to tickets.
Very good. Well, we hope a lot of people will mark their calendar and seriously consider supporting this lovely event coming up on September 17th at the Kenosha Women's Club. A gala for the Kenosha Women's Network as they celebrate their 40th anniversary. Roseanne Shales, President, Guida Brown, Vice President of the Kenosha Women's Network. It's been great to speak with you on part one of today's morning show. We wish you and your organization the very, very best going forward.
Thank you so much, Greg.
Good to have you here. And here is part two of today's morning show here on WGTD. And I am indeed privileged and honored to be speaking for the next few minutes on our morning show with a highly acclaimed English actor, Robert Bathurst. He has extensive experience on British stages and British television, and over here in America, we probably know him best for his wonderful performance as Sir Anthony on Downton Abbey. What we're going to be speaking with Robert Bathurst about, however, today is the marvelous work that he has done in narrating, if you want to say, the audiobooks, the most recent in the series of Armand Gamache novels by Canadian novelist Louise Penny. The latest, the 17th book in this series, has just been published, called The Madness of Crowds. And Robert Bathurst once again brings his distinguished voice to the task of bringing this novel alive for those that prefer to hear it in audiobook fashion. And we have Robert Bathurst with us for a few minutes to talk about this. Robert Bathurst, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hi, Greg. Lovely to be here with you.
I'm so glad to be talking with you. Before we speak about the novel specifically, I would love to hear a bit about your approach, which I think is so masterful, your approach to audiobooks. And I heard you say in another interview something about the subtle dance that is involved in doing this kind of work. Explain to our listeners, please, what this subtle dance is all about.
Well, anyone who's seen me dancing wouldn't ever call me subtle, but in terms of reading, thank you for picking up on that. It is a dance because what is the job of a narrator is to be a conduit between the author and the listener. Because when you're reading a book, it's direct. You're reading the print. Louise has written the print, and that's what you're receiving. Everything that's going on in your imagination has been transferred through reading the print. Then with audiobooks, you've got this additional thing going on with somebody taking the responsibility of reading it for you. So you can listen to it in the car, on a walk, or wherever it is like that, but you've still got to create that connection between the author and the listener and not get in the way, not be boring, not make it all about you, not make it about your mellifluous tones and your, you know, the way your the voice beautiful, you know, like they do in so much poetry reading. It's nothing to do with you. It's everything to do with the performance in getting it across, but not about the individual doing it. It's rather an unfashionable view because, you know, everything in performance is meant to be embodied and meant to be about oneself, but it isn't in this case at all, ever. Mm. You've just got to serve the author, and all the characterizations, all the rhythms, pick up, prepare it absolutely inside out, and then work out what it is the author intends. And if it's well written, which Louise Penny's work always is, she tells you in the writing how what where it's picking up, where the rhythm is, what the speed at which you go, the sentence structure. And so just to be alive to that, and most of all to be alive to how the audience are receiving it, whether you're engaging them or not.
One of the things that I have appreciated, and I've heard, I think, two of these previous novels, your readings of them, is that you seem to adopt a style that is vivid, but not what I would call overly histrionic. Is that part of what we're talking about here in terms of not getting between the listener and the book, inserting yourself in the wrong way? Is it partly not being too histrionic?
Well, I'm up for doing histrionic if it's written. I mean, if the character is being histrionic, I'll give it histrionic. But not to make it a reading which is too declaimed. I mean, if you want to, you know, to make it into someone in the Roman Senate and shouting out through the forum, if that character is shouting, then yeah, declaim it. But in narration, I say narration, you say narration. But anyway, so it's something you just draw them in, because there's two different styles, aren't there? There's one you either draw people in or you pin them back. Mm. I'm more of a drawer-inner. Mm. Pinning back is all very well, but it can get a bit tiresome after a while.
It seems to me another matter here is respecting and trusting the material, and not feeling as though it is destined for failure unless you bring your own greatness to it. I mean, you clearly believe right from the start that these works by Louise Penny are marvelous, and you simply need to share them without, in a sense, adding something to them that isn't already there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the language is there to be squeezed. And you want to squeeze it, and you want to get as much juice out of it as possible. And any reader would have a different way of doing that. Of course, yes, you respect it and you serve it. But it's nothing to do with the reader. Mm-hmm. I'd say that it's all about those characters. It's all about that phrase. Every phrase, you're making a decision. You're making a choice in how to deliver it. But if what's really important is the listener isn't aware of those choices being made, and the only choices they're aware of is the choice of the author as to which way that sentence is going to go.
I don't recall if this is where you began this work, that is, with these Louise Penny novels and the Armand Gamache series, or did you begin this work with some other project?
Narration. I mean, in terms of my career, I started in radio. I started in radio comedy, and have done a lot of radio drama in terms of sort of voice work. Book narration has come much later, actually. I've always done sort of short stories and things like that on the radio, but the narration side of my career has come relatively late, in amongst all the sort of the telly and the theatre stuff.
And did it begin with narrating these novels by Louise Penny?
I'd done a few books before, but this is the first major raft of books that I've done. The series was started. First 10 of this series was read by the actor Ralph Cosham, who died having done 10 of the books. I've done the last 7.
Right.
So the success of the series is owing a lot to him. It was a great pressure because he was very popular with the fans of the Three Pines series, the Gamache series. Mm. And so I took over and it seems to have gone pretty well. So the people who like her work in audio seem to be listening in good numbers to the latest books.
For certain.
I've done the last 7 of them. So this is the greatest body of audiobook work that I've done, yes, certainly.
And I wanted to ask you about that, the fact that you are stepping in and following in the footsteps of Ralph Cosham, as you already said, whose work on this series was highly regarded. Had you heard those, and did you feel any sense of needing to follow in some sort of continuity from what he had done before you, or was that not possible? Did you need to do this with yourself, in a sense, and your own voice?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't want to do a pale reflection of him, and it would only be that. So I did. I briefly listened to the work that he'd done, and he did brilliantly. But no, I had to just forge it myself. And so I read it and reacted to it, and I couldn't refer to what had gone on before because that was his interpretation. And I took the view that I would interpret it and give it the rhythms and everything else without. Trying to recreate or restore the tone of what was going on before, because these characters have got to live, these characters have got to somehow buzz, and if it's too remote a business to try and do an impersonation and then do that, so I wanted it to come from deeper and to land it in my own way.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I am speaking with highly acclaimed English actor Robert Bathurst, and we are talking about the work that he has done recently, reading aloud the marvelous novels of Louise Penny in the series of Chief Inspector Armand Gamache. The 17th novel in the series has just been released, called The Madness of Crowds. Robert Bathurst, explain to our listeners something of this central character of Chief Inspector Armand Gamache, a man who is so commendable in so many ways. What do you make of him, and what do you bring to the character?
Well, I bring what hopefully Louise Penny brings, but I he's fascinating in the sense that he's really tough. He's complicated, but he's also got, and the books exude this. They've got a sort of, despite all the terrible things that go on, and the things that Gamache has to do and the compromises he's got to make, there is through it all, and I think this is one of the great appeals to it. There is a sort of with a small less spiritual sense in it that. Ultimately, I think the message that Louise gets across, and it isn't syrupy and soupy to say this, but goodness prevails in the sense that, I mean, things go badly awry, but ultimately there is a sense of redemption, and it's I think quite rare in this genre, perhaps, He's sort of a remarkable character. I think sometimes he's not unlike sort of Aslan in the C.S. Lewis Narnia tales. I mean, there's a sort of an element of sort of odd spiritual goodness about him, even though he's down and mucky with the most ghastly things that go on in his life. But so he sort of straddles that sense of toughness with a sense of unfashionable goodness. Mm. Which goodness is really hard to make dramatically interesting, because mostly it's complication that does that, and real. Louise Penny pulls that off brilliantly, I think.
This novel is set primarily in the little village, I think it's a fictional village, of Three Pines, Quebec, which has a real spirit sort of all of its own. Describe to our listeners your understanding of this small community of Three Pines, Quebec, and what makes it such a perfect backdrop for the events of this novel.
Yes, well, Three Pines is not only not on the map, although it's physical and it's there and people live in it. You don't find it on sat-nav, she says in the early books. But it's also Three Pines is also, in a strange way, a sort of state of mind. And it's a place where people who are sort of lost go. And by lost, I think she includes the entire population of the world in that way, because everyone's got some sort of something. Everybody has lost. And everybody is striving for something that they can't quite attain or can't find. And So in a way, it is a sort of strange place of sanctuary, of almost healing. Now, having said that, there's an awful lot of murders that go on in Three Pines. So every second book, something major happens in Three Pines, and every second book, something major happens elsewhere, either in Quebec or last year with her book, it was in Paris. But Three Pines is the center of a lot of action. But also there is this sense of balm in the place, which she writes, and she writes extremely sensually. She writes very well about food and about smells, and so it is a place is a wonderful place to be and a wonderful place to read about. But there's always something afoot.
Right, your mention of food brings to mind the many scenes that are set in the bistro in Three Pines, Quebec.
Yes, indeed, and someone has written a website called The Nature of the Feast. I mean, I have to say that the reason is it came after one of her books was called The Nature of the Beast. So anyway, he's written a whole series of recipes that you might find at the bistro, which is and it's sort of vaguely set in Knowlton. Vaguely, I mean, she says that Knowlton is her sort of place, so yes, the bistro, but all sorts of things happen in the bistro as well. There's been some shootouts, as well as all the lovely confit of duck the fine brie and baguette you get there. You've got to watch out for the bullets sometimes.
Yes, exactly. This latest novel by Louise Penny, The Madness of Crowds, is set essentially in a post-pandemic world, and explain to our listeners why this is so essential to the central events of the novel.
Yes, it takes in post-pandemic, so it's slightly in the future when things have completely calmed down. Yes, I mean, it takes into account the fact that for the last 18 months or so, the world has been united in one way, in its anxiety around the virus. And completely riven in really febrile and ugly, I wouldn't even call it debate, overlapping declamations of how we should be responding to it, and it's become aligned and tribal and the rest of it, and this febrile atmosphere is something from which we have in the book, from which we have emerged. And it has left us very scarred, really, from the whole thing. And so when somebody comes to talk at a university, who is renowned for her extreme views in one way, the reaction to her, very extreme in different directions, is really sharpened by our all collective experience of the anxiety and the fears that we've all been through.
This guest that you are talking about, Professor Abigail Robinson, a statistics professor, believes that the best, straightest pathway back to normalcy is to prioritize certain lives over others. And it is a view that is shocking, horrifying to many, but others find that it makes a great deal of sense and are drawn to her. And Chief Inspector Armand Gamache is called to provide security when she comes to Three Pines to give a lecture at a nearby university. And he finds himself having to protect somebody whose views he finds abhorrent. It seems to me that that is one of the most intriguing themes of the novel, is Gamache trying to come to terms with who this woman is, what she believes, and whether or not he feels even comfortable playing this role in her life. Can you tell us more about that conflicted state of mind in which Inspector Gamache finds himself?
Yes, I mean, he is conflicted with the professional and the personal. I mean, he is there to protect someone whose views he finds abhorrent. And I think this works. I mean, I think a lot of professional people would recognize that. I mean, lawyers, if the person on the operating theater table is someone you don't agree with, will you do a better operation than with someone with whom you do agree politically? it must be a constant conflict, perhaps, with many people. A lot of professionals would say, no, of course not. We do the job, and our own personal feelings are irrelevant. But, of course, he has to investigate something which happens, which means he has to get very close to her and to her opinions, and also the world around those opinions, and makes discoveries about people who are connected to this this way of thinking, and it becomes an investigation. So certainly he is there initially to protect and then to investigate, but at no stage does he resile from the responsibility to protect her. And in fact, he puts himself in great danger on her behalf. And so, there is this conflict of the personal and the professional.
And, of course, for him, there is a very specifically personal reason why he is so shocked by her advocacy for what amounts to legally mandated euthanasia for the elderly and for instance, youngsters with Down syndrome. He has a granddaughter, if I remember correctly, who is Down syndrome. And so in the world that Professor Abigail Robinson proposes, his own granddaughter potentially would be euthanized, and he must somehow overlook this or live with this as he protects Professor Robinson. It's interesting to think about the moral dilemma in which he finds himself.
Yes, and it's not just Gamache. I mean, his number two and son-in-law, Jean-Guy Beauvoir, is also extremely exercised by this. And without giving anything away, there is a crescendo of great weight and personal choice that he has to summon and he has to master his own, or whether he succeeds or not, I won't say, his own taste, distaste, and motivation for doing something that, again, would be unprofessional, but would also be seeing through his own personal rage about this person.
A last quick question: can you explain to our listeners the intriguing title of this novel, "The Madness of Crowds"?
The reference actually there is a book that's I think it is a phrase that has been used in something. I must indeed look it up. I ought to know what the reference is. But it is a reflection of this sort of craziness that has overtaken us, and the concern where friends are falling out, where people are aligning themselves one way or the other so firmly that they can't communicate with each other. So the movement of opinion and the recruitment of particular sides in this whole debate, and it goes more widely than just this issue, is something which a lot of people find very disconcerting.
The novel, again, is The Madness of Crowds. It's by Louise Penny, the 17th book in this series around Chief Inspector Armand Gamache, and reading the audiobook, Robert Bathurst. Robert Bathurst, it's been wonderful to speak with you. I commend you on the wonderful work that you have done with these audiobooks, and, of course, all of the wonderful work that you have done both on screen and on stage. And thank you for being part of the morning show today. Best wishes to you.
And you, Greg. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.